essentially, if you ever want to speak, just raise your hand and I will write your name down on a speaker's list. Everyone gets to speak once before anyone gets to speak twice. Everyone gets to speak twice before anyone gets to speak a third time, so on and so forth. In order that we get through, to go to the next item on the agenda, we have to essentially move the previous question. So if you want to, if we're discussing an item and you want to vote on it, you would say something like, I move the previous question. If that receives a second, we will go into discussion about whether or not we are done debating whatever we were debating, and then you would have to agree to close discussion before moving on to the next item on the agenda. It ensures that the assembly is always always on the same page and that everything we do is with the consent of the whole body. So that pretty much covers the basics of Robert's rules.
If any at any point you're uncertain of what you're supposed to do next, or you have something you want to say and not sure how to bring it up, don't hesitate to raise up your hand and just say, I'm not sure how to bring this up, and we can make sure to help you fix it.
Yep, so that is pretty much how Robert's Rules works. It's pretty standard. Does anyone have any questions? No? Okay, great. Then, does anyone have any late additions to the agenda? Does anyone have anything they wanted to bring up that they did not have a chance to submit before the agenda deadline? No? Okay. Then we should have the meeting minutes from May 2nd, but given that the agenda, the wrong agenda was printed, we'll have to do those either as a late addition later in the meeting or at the next meeting.
I think the May 2nd. Are there,
yes.
Yeah. Oh, I guess
we have them attached.
Oh, great.
And they did go out with the email.
Oh. Well then.
Move we accept the amendments.
Is there a second?
Second.
There's a second. Okay. Is there any dissent to moving the minutes? All right. Seeing no dissent, the meeting minutes are approved. Thank you for pointing that out. The next item of business is a report from the student assembly. Given that Jung is not here, the next person would be Al. So, what's going on with the student assembly?
Last week we met with Laura Spitz concerning the thrust of the cut for international student financial aid. Fortunately, President Pollock was doing pretty light out, and that program was immediately reinstated. However, this week I expect our conversations will center around university protections for DACA students, considering the decisions made at the federal level.
Okay, great. Any questions for Alec? No? All right, then next we'll have Rena from the president of the GPSA.
We had our first meeting last week on August the 28th, and we mainly did a lot of introductions to the structure of the GPSA, to standing rules and committees and things like that. And we are, I think, finalizing and accepting committee applications right now, and also reviewing charter and bylaw, which will come up next week in our meeting.
Okay, any questions for Rena? No? All right, next is Ulysses. Ulysses, can you hear me?
I can hear you all just fine. For those of you who are not close to the laptop or the mic, if you could speak boisterously, that would be great. But I hear you just fine, Gabe and Rena, who just spoke. So with that, I guess the Employee Assembly has been meeting all summer, of course, because we'd never leave. So we actually had a retreat over the summer as well. We followed up a couple things we did. The big one being following up on the Board of Trustees presentation that we did in late spring, the request from the chair, Bob Harrison, for us to actually submit our recommendations in formal resolution form to the board that call for the creation of a board-level committee that's focused on the workforce, as well as creating an additional employee-elected trustee, not just for the sake of equity, but because we have 10,000 staff that one employee, or that's just Ithaca-based staff, that one employee is not actually able to represent that well. So Those were the two big things we did with that. In addition, we are going to be hearing tomorrow a presentation from Amy Parmalee, who's going to be talking about the transition that we're making to now tracking time in Workday, which is a big deal for those of you who have only used Kronos before. So this is going to be a big transition for a lot of other administrative units to start using that. We're going to be creating a staff strategic plan, hopefully this semester. In addition, the president's address to staff has been scheduled for October 10th. So that will be Martha Pollack's first time addressing the broader staff community personally. And so that will be held in Clarman Hall during the lunch hour for all staff to participate. So we're looking forward to doing that and presenting some employee appreciation awards as well. But our hands are quite full this semester. We're borrowing some language from the student assembly as well and clarifying our extension policy, because that is an issue that has surfaced recently. So that should be it for us, unless I missed something that Jeremy thinks of.
No, that sounds like plenty.
Okay, any questions for Ulysses? Okay, then Charlie, you're up.
Report from the faculty. So the senate hasn't met and won't for 2 weeks. The 1 week delay is at Cornell Tech next week and so on. I was mentioning like maybe three big things we're going to be doing. So one is to get the ball rolling on developing an official university level policy on consensual relationships. This is driven, this is a topic that's been around for 2 years, and the starting point for our work will be GPSA 14, which passed in May. Right now we're trying to figure out or work out the details of how to proceed, you know, what kind of committee and so on. And I would say that in 2 weeks we'll pretty much have that figured out. Over the summer, I did a cut and paste job. The faculty handbook's a mess, a lot of redundancy and so on. I did a cut and paste job over the summer to clean a lot of that up. And so it's reshaped, and a lot of redundancy has been removed. Part of that, in many ways, one of the most important parts of the handbook has to do with promotions, tenure, appeals, and so on. And that arena needs very careful revision with, you know, full faculty oversight. So that's that'll be an ongoing thing this fall. A few things following up from last year. The new calendar is going to start in 1 year, and there's a lot of work to do in preparation for that. But orientation is expanded, and this has to be very carefully done, and I want to make sure there's enough, you know, faculty oversight. We have they're great people across the colleges and in first-year programs who work on this, but we have to, just, you know, faculty and students should be pay attention. And the other part associated with the new calendar has to do with exams, the Educational Policy Committee is basically reevaluating every single memo that you've seen dealing with, you know, rules about exams, rules about prelims, rules about study week, just to rethink all that because the scheduling is different. Another thing we didn't quite wrap up last year was a complete rethink and we have a whole new policy concerned with emeritus, the promotion, the awarding of emeritus status. And that will wrap up this fall with the Senate involvement and so on. Yeah.
Yeah, about the consensual relationship, I just had a conversation with Michelle about that. And I had a long-term staff member who was a faculty member, so he was reflecting on a particular interest. Bringing it up to me, because perhaps as a body which represents the whole of the university, we might have some discussion about that so that it doesn't appear to be entirely a faculty-related issue. In particular, I was curious, and I thought about this, the relationship of it to our campus code of conduct, which from the beginning we've maintained is a university-wide for all members, from staff through to faculty. Now, I realize there's certain aspects that go into department chairs and some go to supervisors and so forth, but I do think that we ought to, at the same time thinking about this issue as a faculty issue, think about its implications and whether for the environment, the judicial environment as a whole in the university, and how that, if it seems appropriate, should be translated into something that goes into the campus code of conduct if it's not already there.
Okay, so first of all, I think the big takeaway starting from 2 years ago and me studying over the summer in GPSA 14 is that no one, including the faculty, owns this issue. It's faculty, students, and staff. Whatever group looks at this should reflect that. So not to bring it up again, but the calendar committee is that kind of thing. It touches everybody. Everybody should be involved, not just, say, a faculty committee with consultants from HR or the council's office. We need on board people right from the start, from HR, Title IX, and whatever. I think the end result should be a title at the level of 6.4 and something that stands up there. It clearly intersects 6.4, but only by elevating it to that. Not that the policy library is something, it's good, it has flaws, but the point of elevating it to that level, it gives a certain amount of authority to it. Okay. Right now, the policy is buried in the faculty handbook. It's like three paragraphs written in 1995 or whatever. It's there, you can find it, but again, I think it has to be elevated to the policy library level. I think we can certainly talk about how the campus code, whether that's the appropriate home or not. I guess my thinking right now, and this is just me, we have the form committees and a lot of discussion, but I think that's the proper place to put it. I think if
which is the proper place?
I think a freestanding policy at
right.
The 6.4 level.
I see.
I think that's the everything's up for discussion, and I think this is one of the topics today about the code and the redoing of that. So there's a certain amount of urgency to this. I think the graduate students are right to say that we dragged our feet. This is progress has been very slow. All right, we got to really move this along. I would sort of say it's going to be a big enough deal to get it to the policy level. I've looked into all the steps you have to take. It's all doable. What I'm kind of worried is off the top of my head that the code has been redone in a very fundamental way. We get tangled up in that. I'd much rather see this nice, crisp, easy-to-read, effective policy that's out there and sends a real strong signal.
Yes, I didn't mean to imply that it should be slowed down by the
code. I know, yeah.
I'm simply interested in making it clear that the code, which we've maintained, pertains to all of the university, and it is a way of setting standards, or at least qualitative
sure.
standards. It should have something substantial in it. Now, it doesn't have to be written before if anything substantial comes out in terms of guidelines or policies, but it should definitely be immediately, if not coordinatedly, begun to reflect whatever comes out in the 6s and 9s.
Right.
But anyway, that particular document.
Yeah. But because consensual matters and harassment matters are in this area are like this, I think
yep.
you want something sort of in parallel with 6.4,
right.
Cross references and all that.
Right. So just we should develop a mechanism
sure.
for it being parallel,
right.
as opposed to something that's in the future.
Right.
But thank you.
Okay. Great. Any other questions for Charlie?
Quick question. I don't know if the microphone moved, but I actually can't hear you all anymore. Just FYI.
Oh.
I know Charlie was speaking because somebody said his name, but I don't know what he said, so.
Well, I
can't remember what I said, so we'll have to offline and we can have a chat.
Yeah, then we'll reconnect offline. I apologize for that, Ulysses.
Not
sorry.
Sure.
Okay, so anything else for Charlie? No? Okay, then before we move on, I actually apologize for not addressing this earlier. I guess I'll give a little report from the UA. The most important thing is actually welcoming new members. So some of you are new, some of you are old. I didn't have exactly the names down before, but I think I got it now. So, if you can just wave when I call your name so that everyone knows who everyone else is. From the graduate and professional students, Elena, Catherine, and then then technically Matt Battaglia, he was not on the assembly last year, but he's a familiar face. From the undergraduates, Alec, Naj, Joe, and Jung is gonna be late, I think. And then from the faculty end, Richard. All right, great, so yeah, welcome to the UA. So thanks for being part of this. All right, that was all I had from the UA. I guess next we'll move to committee reports. And so we'll start with the Campus Infrastructure Committee, Naj.
Hi everyone, as Gabe just mentioned, my name is Naj. Super excited to be on the UA this year, so thank you for having me. This year I'll be the head of the Campus Infrastructure Committee. I want to note that we are still accepting applications, so if anyone wants to join, I'm more than excited to have you on the team, and I think it's going to be really a great year where we can start working on initiatives that are going to have some great impact here on campus. I just wanted to note that some things that I wanted to work on within the committee and within anyone on the UA who might be interested in helping is on transportation here on campus, specifically with Big Red Shuttle. I'm really hoping for some change in the university, having that not only funded by the community center, but more so on a university level, as other universities do have programs where they actually do have transportation programs in place that offer more safety on campus, essentially, for all students, for anybody part of the community. So we're still figuring out when our meetings are gonna be. I'm waiting to have more applications come through, where I'm gonna figure out who's gonna be part of the committee, so we can make sure that we find a date that works well for everyone. But I'm looking forward to a really great year and to getting started a little better.
Okay, great. It looks like we have our the agendas. Thanks so much for going back and getting those. Marty, do you have something to add?
Well, I have something to add because I'm a representative to the Campus Planning Committee, and that's related to the Infrastructure Committee. And I just wanted to say that over the summer, there's been a lot of motion to fulfill the plans for Cornell to get closer to carbon neutrality in 2035 by constructing a large solar energy generating facility that will offset up to 16% of Cornell's electricity needs, and that it's gone through many, many meetings through the summer, and it looks like in the fall later it will be constructed and we'll have that accomplishment. And there's more going on in campus planning along those lines, but we'll be reporting periodically.
That sounds great. Look forward to working on that.
Any other questions for Naj? No? All right, next I believe is the CWC. Joe?
The CWC set its first meeting date to next Tuesday, September 12th from 1 to 2 p.m. It's going to be in Day Hall. I haven't heard back which room yet, but we will get a room. We will be discussing the logistics for the tobacco-free campus referendum that will be incoming. We will look towards University Assembly Resolution 9 that was passed last semester to see what Martha Pollack has, if she wants to eliminate any lines, because going through that, there were some problematic lines that she might remove, so we would have to adjust how the referendum has worked. We're going to go through the logistics of that referendum, and then we're going to set a couple goals for this whole entire academic year, see what the priorities are of the committee members, to see where we stand, and hopefully if anyone else has things to add to the committee, we are basically here to catch anything that you all need. Yeah.
Great. Any questions for Joe? No? All right. Then noting that Matt is going to be a little bit late, we actually pushed him to the bottom of the agenda, so the next committee report would be the Executive Committee. Anna, you have the floor.
All right, so we have a new website, as you've hopefully all heard by now, thanks to the OA. Hopefully you've all had a chance to check it out. Given the transition, given everything, I want to make sure that everyone is getting my emails. So can I see a show of hands if you did not get the agenda for this meeting? All right.
We didn't get it this week. So.
Then I will work on that. And then,
if I may, on the website, there's actually on the front page, it's if you want to be added to any of the news lists or info lists for agenda or things, you can just sign yourselves right up. But we'll make sure that you both get on.
Awesome. Thank you. And I'm also anticipating a pretty busy year for the University Assembly. So please do get in touch with me if you have have agenda items you would like us to address this year. We've already heard a few things. DACA, I'm sure we will have more things coming up. So far, I've only heard from a small handful of you. And then please have your constituent assemblies send reps to our various committees. Other than that, I'm good.
Okay, the only thing that I would like to add to that is, in case you don't know the URL for the website, it's assembly.cornell.edu. Pretty straightforward, feel free to browse around on that. It looks really nice, and you know, I'm excited to be using it because I'll be interfacing with that, you know, quite a bit. But that's the website. Okay. Any questions for Anna? No? Okay. Then with that, we will move into our business of the day. We have only one item, an important item. We'll have a presentation from Michelle Horvath. She's the current judicial administrator. She's been in her position since, I think, June 22nd of 2016. Did I have that right?
June 21st. Okay.
21st. Okay. Close enough. We're very happy to have you here. So thanks for coming, and feel free to start whenever you're ready.
Well, hello everyone, welcome back. If you were away from Christmas in the summer, if you are here, welcome back to the school year, because that's just exciting. As Gabe mentioned, my name is Michelle Horvath, and I serve as a judicial administrator, and as required by the code, I come to present to y'all. And I have to apologize because I was planning to come with the full analytic data for the year. But when I pulled the data, which was my first time doing it here, it turns out our number system for our database system doesn't run on what we deem as the academic year. It goes from August 1st instead of July 1st. And so I don't have the full data because when we were tracking the numbers, it didn't add up to our internal numbers. So I'm going to provide a little bit of a qualitative report first and then come back in October with the full data. I say that with the grace of the chair and UA, thank you for that invitation, and I'd rather present accurate information than inaccurate information. So I do want to provide kind of a quick summary of some of the things where we've been last year and where we're going this year. I want to leave plenty of time for questions and then talk about some of the transparency measures and the way that I will be asking for some help from the University Assembly and y'all's constituencies. So first of all, as Gabe mentioned, I started last year, and so I came to the Assembly with pretty much just a philosophical overview and talking about how I interpret the code of freedom with responsibility, meaning adult choices come with adult consequences. That my office will never be one to say that you can't do X, you can't do Y, you can't do Z. It's that you've come to this university and you've come to this community knowing that we have a campus code of conduct, agreeing to the values of our system, and if you choose to, for example, deface a building because you are so strongly wanting to portray a message, that's wonderful, but there's going to be consequences for facilities and the cost of renovating. And so that's kind of a little bit of a different shift, that we're saying that, you know, 9 times out of 10, you may drink underage. If on the 10th time CUPD catches you and they make a referral to our office, it's just time to take responsibility for that. We'll look at the procedures and follow those, but that's the philosophy that we take. And so we come to that from kind of two different perspectives. The first is a very strong recognition of that we have to preserve fundamental fairness, that there are certain requirements of the code and of just basic decency that we need to adhere to. The second is that we really look at developmental theory. And so even though the code does cover faculty, staff, and students, the overarching majority of our cases are students. And so we look at this from the best practices with student development theory. And so we say that this is really a learning opportunity to say that there are chances for us to learn from the decisions we make so that we're either able to be more productive members of the society that we are in, or we're really trying to understand our decision-making potential. And so when I talked about this to the Assembly last year, I was sort of like, okay, how are you going to implement this? Those are kind of some nice thoughts, but let's look at some clear ways that we're able to do it. So one of the things that was really important to me is that we were looking to streamline our case adjudication, because we thought that there was a lot of gaps between the time of reporting to our office and the time we were able to adjudicate that. That was important because of the developmental opportunity to have a more rich conversation closer to the decision was being lost. And so one of the things that we implemented this year, which I'm very excited for, was that we did an online reporting form. This is available on our website. And so one of the changes that students came to us is that the police officers used to give them these yellow JA tickets, right? Now they give them a business card that says you've been referred to the JA today, here's your case number, because the incident is inputted on our online reporting system, which means that we are able to open cases and notify respondents much quicker because we have that information without waiting to type in the report like previous years. And so that's been a really big change to our office, that we're able to adjudicate cases much more quickly, and we're going to support that developmental problem because we're having those conversations earlier. Another change that we did is that we looked at every single document that our office had last year. And we said, if I was a respondent getting this information, I've had no other contact with the JA, would I be able to understand this? And so the code and all of the things that it does well, being clear isn't one of them. There's dense language. It's really not a plain English document. And so we looked for ways, how can we really use the code language and then explain it? So we did a lot of like frequently asked questions documents. We looked at ways to give a respondent preparing for hearing all the information that they would need so that it's not piecemeal throughout the process. Looking at the ways for us to move towards a more restorative justice point of view and have that development is that we started a pilot program with the Scheinman Institute on Conflict Resolution last year. We looked at the partnership in two ways. We said, can we reach SDAs with student mediators? And can we use these student mediators who are getting this really wonderful training that they can't apply in a lot of cities to do some facilitated dialogues? So for example, if a student or a respondent steals some books from the bookstore, one of the great campus partners that we've been working with is the bookstore, so that the risk management officer can say, here's how the theft kind of impacted the bookstore, the cost, the price, things of that nature. And then the student has the opportunity to restore the relationship, to say, you know, I'm not a bad person. This is why I took the books. This isn't my normal course of behavior. And we're really finding that there's some really rich conversations going on at that point. I'm happy to announce that pilot program that we piloted last spring is now a full program, continuing with the Scheinman Institute, and it's actually now credit-bearing. So the individuals who participate in that will be able to get academic credit. And what has been even wonderful is that we've had other Ivy campuses ask us if they could send their students to participate in that program. And we're not quite there yet. We need to kind of make sure that we're strong in that, but that really opens the opportunity to work with some of our colleagues and other campuses in a little bit more of a rich, consistent manner. One of the other things that we were able to implement last year, which really reflects the developmental approach that we are really trying to move the office towards, is we did a probation program that we said, you know, there's some students who's, and I only say students because we didn't have any faculty or staff members placed on probation last year, who need a little bit of an extra hand. So we created a full semester curricula for individuals who are on probation. It includes meeting with the JA four times, or the associate JA who handled their case four times a semester, working with career services to explain maybe how to talk to future employers about their conduct history. It involves work with various campus partners to have a mentor relationship that's not associated with the conduct office, but really trying to make the university a little bit smaller and a little less complex. And so we've had some really great feedback from that, and that's based on the Baxter Magnolia's theory of self-authorship. So we really were looking at what would be a great development theory to use for that program to say, these are the adult choices you're making. Does this align with the values that you have for yourself, the values for the university, and the place where you want to be once you leave the university? And so we had about 20 individuals participate in that program last year, and we're on par probably to have a similar number with that. The office also hired a new associate judicial administrator. His name is Ben Ciampolillo, and he has a very strong restorative justice background and a strong background working with students in residence hall settings and campus universities. And so really looking to say that our office is committed to move forward in this educational developmental restorative approach, and we think Ben was the right hire to do that. So he started June 22nd and has really contributed to our office. The last kind of big change that I want to talk about of how we incorporated the development theory and the philosophy that we're bringing to the office is that we had a student intern this summer really doing a lot of deep research and work as to hazing, really understanding how it develops, how we can address it, especially looking at it from a student student intern actually is a Cornell athlete, and so she brings a really rich perspective. We were so impressed by her work that we decided to invite her to serve as a student employee for the year. And so we have a student internship program really grounded in experiential learning that we would open up to anyone who needs students and credits or from other campuses, and really looking to partner and grow that, because we think that student voice in the office is so important. As caseload-wise, our office handled over 400 cases last year, some involving multiple respondents. So, for example, one case had 13 respondents, one case could have one respondent. So, it doesn't really talk fully about the load, but we had about a little over 400 cases. With the public records, which are available at our office for review at any time, we had 4 show cause hearings, which means that individuals petitioned the University Hearing Board to say that they disagreed with our decision to take action or not to take action. We had 7 hearing on the merits, which is meaning that the JA and the respondent can't come to an agreement as to either the finding of responsibility or finding of sanctions. So we had 7 hearings on the merits, one of which was an abstention and one of which was a public hearing. Of those 7 cases, 4 of them went to a university review board, which is the first level of appeal. The JA can only appeal if we think that a sanction is disproportionate. A respondent can appeal for any grounds. So evidence not available at the time, thinking that the outcome is not commensurate with the violations of the responsibility found. And so 4 of the 7 cases went to an appeal, and then 2 of those 4 cases were eligible for a final appeal because they involved acts of violence. One of the questions that the UA had for me last year was my thoughts on interim measures. And I committed publicly, because it supports my philosophy, that I use interim measures very sparingly. So these are interim suspensions, no contact directives, or moving of individuals from residence halls. This past year, we implemented 1 interim suspension, and that was for an organization, and we issued 0 no contact directives. That's not to say that we haven't had requests, but the requests that we received, we didn't think met the level of reaching the requirements of the code as articulated. I will note that because most of the gender-based misconduct in the Title IX 6.4 policy is the interim measures are not handled by our office, I think that accounts for one of the shift declines, but I did make that commitment, and I think that the time when I've asked for the interim suspension, it was used sparingly. As we're looking towards the academic year for 2018, I want to talk about some things that we're really doing again to take the office to the next level. The first is that we have created a suspension reintegration program. And this is modeled off of the Circles of Support and Accountability method, really piloted by Robin Wilson, and which has been duplicated in various countries and in various states around the U.S. This is a criminal justice model, which we're not using because we think that criminal justice models are appropriate in this educational setting, and the violations in which the circles were originally created tended to be in the sexual assault setting, but they've been used in probation settings. But we like it because we think there's a rich way for individuals who are coming back from suspension to be supported as they successfully reintegrate to Cornell. We're also piloting a decision-making class. Most of the individuals who come to our office aren't coming to our office because they have had a deep desire to violate the code. It's something with the decision-making process that either other alternates weren't thought out more quickly, things of that nature. So we are piloting a decision-making class for some of our sanctions where individuals spend 3 hours really going through the book Smart Choices and having a first part of the curriculum that talks about reflection and really kind of looking at decision-making based off of things like personality types versus criminal justice theories and lots of different kind of 5 different curriculums we're piloting 1 this semester. We're also committed as an office this year to look at more opportunities for us to get in front of audiences as a prevention method. I think there's been this fear that anytime the JA comes to a meeting or comes to an event, something's about to go wrong and the whole world is going to collapse, right? That's kind of the thing, is that when we walk into the room, the conversation stops. So we're really looking for ways to talk about, let's educate the campus community as what the expectations are. So we think we'll be in a much better place for prevention than we are having to be reactionary. So as was being mentioned with the calendar changes, opportunities to speak speak at orientation and to really have a little bit more robust presence so that we're putting people on a path for success instead of having their first meeting with us once there's been a violation. There are some immediate code changes that I've asked the CJC to consider and the chair of UA to consider. We met and we kind of talked about these. Really looking at what would be some things that we immediately need to address in a way to make the process more developmental and to address some of the challenges that we saw as an office last year. The next kind of big change that we're looking for this year is that we are going to completely revise our website. We're looking for a lot of feedback, and I have the dates of some focus groups that we would like anyone from your constituencies to really kind of come to our office and say, if I was a respondent, this is the information that I would need to know and how to be successful. So our website has had this little construction cone on it for a little bit longer than I would like, but I would rather make sure that we have the feedback from the community before we start to really look at the process of revising that. And so, and I'll provide these dates to the clerk, but September 12th from 5 to 6, September 20th from 10 to 11 a.m., and September 21st from 4 to 5. And we'll just be having kind of some focus groups in 120-day hall and just asking for feedback. So really saying, what do you want on this website? How could it be helpful? What would you need to know? Additionally, if anyone has any feedback from your constituencies, please feel free to direct that to me. I will keep a running list of recommendations and things of that nature because we just want to make sure that we're a primary resource, bless you, for that. Kind of in summary, a few other things before I kind of open up to questions and some open space is that one of our priorities has to continue to build campus partnerships. One of the unique things about the role of the judicial administrator is that we see the whole campus. Our limitation is not directed by college, by campus, and things of that nature. So being able to see kind of the overarching view of the university is a really unique perspective, and we've been able to build a lot of partnerships and bridges because of that, and so that's going to be a commitment that we continue to do moving forward, especially with the Office of the Judicial Codes Counselors. Yeah. They have been great partners. They've been a good check on both of our systems, and I really envy their ability to work with students directly, but they're doing a really wonderful job, and we'll continue to strengthen that relationship. Again, working on changing the perception of our office. It's not something that's a positive thing when students have asked us if they're going to jail. That should never be a question that a student comes or even has in the back of their mind. And that's a question that has come up at least 3 times this past year. And if it was anecdotally once, it's funny. If it's second time, it's questioning. The third time is a representative of a problem. And so, looking kind of towards that, as we kind of mentioned a little bit about the table, I'm really asking the University Assembly and the CJC to really see when would be the time for our university to at least have broad conversations about the code. I'm really saying is a time to really look at this and say, it's been serving us very well. Where are ways that we can improve it? Where are the ways that we can be advancing the best practices? Because when I look at the history of the code, this was a very proactive document that set the bar higher than kind of any campus had before. And I think we can say there was a lot of events that led to that. But I don't know if we would say that our campus code is the best practice and the marquee. My goal is always to be have our campus code be the one that every other college looks to and says, they're doing it right. Let's really kind of partner with them and share from them. So that is a request that I am making of this body and the CJC and the work that they do in that committee. But I do want to start to open up those conversations. So I left about 10 minutes for questions and open space. I'm happy to elaborate a little bit more deeply on anything that I've mentioned. And again, I will have the full data numbers that breaks down by offense and violation in October. But it was more important for me to get that correct before I presented to you versus having to retract it. So.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for your presentation. This is a quick reminder. If you have any questions about like a fact, like I don't know what this acronym means, just make a point of information and I'll try to answer that. If you would like to speak, raise your hand and I'll add your name to the speakers list. So the first person on the speakers list is Matt.
First off, thank you. I do apologize for my tardiness in the class. I unfortunately stuck out of that early. I must say I laud all the efforts in this office. As you mentioned, myself and Mr. Collins had a very, I think, insightful conversation with you on Friday. And I think this year, looking in terms after I know speaking with a number of members of this body and community members, I personally have received a number of areas that maybe for clarifications, as well as areas in terms of questions as of why do we do this. And I think those are very important to air publicly. I think in terms of, I also would say I praise your office's very strongly, your office's goals to try and change the perception there, or even when you're going through the process of selecting, you know, that's one of the things that stuck out to me, that your idea of what the GA's office could be and should be. And especially looking at that, even moving forward, I think in terms of our code, one of the things that it was at its time, a very high level document, I think it still is, a lot of the concern that I've encountered when speaking with members of the community as well as members of my own committee was that because it set the bar high, that if we open it up, there's a risk that the bar might get lowered. And I think that's a public relations challenge, and I think it's important to realize that you can improve the code without sacrificing the procedural protections that made it revolutionary for its day. And I wish to say I look forward to working with you and your office to help accomplish that, and look forward to growing through here. So thank you for coming.
Thank you.
All right, Charlie, I'll add you to the speakers list. Next is Anna.
Thank you for coming. You mentioned that 4 appeals went to the UHRB. Can I ask how many of them got overturned?
So I have it in front of me. I don't have the actual decisions. And so when we say 4 of the 7 went to URB, I'd have to pull the numbers out to kind of tease those a little bit. I know of the 2 cases that went to the presidential appeal, one was upheld, one the sanction was modified. For the 4 cases that went to a URB appeal, for one of them, the decision was modified by the URB and the sanction was increased. One, the decision was upheld. And I believe for the other one, the hearing was upheld too, but I will have that more in the October report. So I will have that for you, but I will make it a genuine point.
Thank you for doing number crunching right there. Did you have anything else?
Not right now.
Okay, sorry. Then we can come back. Next.
Those are our public records, so you're welcome to come into the office tomorrow morning and read the decisions if you want them. So.
Thank you.
Great. Next is Linda.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm sorry, I have a bit of a cold, so please excuse me. I can't understand me. So we had an excellent presentation by your judicial codes counselor at our main meeting, and he had some very distinct, pointed, and articulate feedback on the campus code of conduct. And I thought it was excellent, and I remember asking him to please write a summary of his points. It was very, you know, they were quite simple and very informed. And I don't know if he ever did that, but I think it would be very helpful considering his familiarity and expertise in this, working with the code during his time here. I can't remember his first name, but it's in the minutes here. And you know, he asked for plain language, he asked for it to reflect community values, he asked for the role of the advisor to be better spelled out. There were about 7 things, and I didn't bring my list of them because I took notes at that meeting, but I thought it was just really insightful advice. And it would seem that that would be a basis for looking at the code, and it didn't seem, I'm not sure why there's a hesitance to move forward to do that, but it would seem to make sense based on his feedback to just do it. So I'm not sure what we have to do to get that report from him or if he ever did it, but you know, I'm just suggesting that. And then the other point that I wanted to make was you said that you had a student working on hazing. And I'm really interested in the interface between Greek life and the code of conduct, considering that a lot of these organizations have their own internal process for figuring out when someone has libeled someone or when someone has, you know, broken the rules. But these are students handling these concerns, and sometimes they're really busy with finals, and the process is very slow, and so I'm kind of wondering if that can't be looked at before it becomes a real issue. So that's just a concern, just from internal, I have a letter and a sorority, and I'm kind of concerned about what's going on. So it just seems like there has to be some, that should be part of the code. At what point does it get escalated out of that system? So.
So the JCCs aren't part of my office. They're an independent office.
Okay.
But I'm sure that there's notes, minutes from the EA meeting that we can look at. Probably Bola was the individual who presented to y'all. With the separation of the grade system, I echo your thoughts. And I know that there have been various committees that have been starting to look at that and really trying to decide where that is balanced at the university system. So my office still has jurisdiction over individual actors in the system, and they go through the same rights and have the same rights and privileges and protections under the code. But I do know that that has been a process that's been looked at, and I believe that UA representation has been on those committees, and I eagerly look forward to kind of their recommendations as well.
Next is Richard.
Michelle.
Yes.
I have a question about the relationship between the code and the OGA's office. So there are different, there's Title IX that the administrators and staff are covered by something else. And it looks like the OGA's office is primarily deals with students who are either complaining against other students or defendants. So if an administrator complains about a student, it goes to you. But if a student complains about an administrator, it goes somewhere else.
If it's the administrator's workplace. So we have jurisdiction over the works of faculty and staff, not the workplace.
So the question really is this, with one code, but all these separate areas of adjudication. What do you see as the differences in the way in which they apply the code?
So policy 6.4 for student respondents, that's a carve out from the code to policy 6.4. So that is, if you think of it, kind of umbrella to the code. The code was written that jurisdiction for faculty and staff is only outside the workplace. So the example that I give is that if I yelled at a student, I could say, well, there might be a pedagogical reason that I did so, and so it's very clearly within my workspace. If I go around and I slash the tires of people in the parking lot because they're taking my spot that I think is mine, then I'm going to get jailed, right? I'm going to have to go sent to the office and we'll have to figure out the logistics of that. And so I think that when you look at the sanctions in the code for faculty and staff, I think there's a reason why it was limited to being outside the workplace. And so I think the university's relationship is very different to faculty and staff. And I think that's the reason why there are these different carve-out procedures. Would it be easy to say that, you know, 100 years ago, when maybe we don't have different court cases for different, you know, rights of tenure rights versus student rights and things of that, could we say it's an easier system to have under one document? Yes. But I think that as we look at the change in scope, we've had to have all these different carve-outs, and especially as we looked at the role of the federal government and state government to implement regulations and regulatory compliance issues, we've had to have some of these separate offices just based on that. So I think it's a mix of a lot of things. I don't know if that quite got to answer your question, but.
Well, it was really about constraints, whether you could realistically have one code for everyone in the university. One code is going to be administered differently in different parts.
Yeah, I mean, I'm one of those people who I think, when people say, is the glass half empty or half full, I'm like, well, it's all full because there's air in it too, so it's not just water. So I'm not going to say that, you know, we can't have one code and have it administered differently, but I think that when we look at relationships between different constituency classes, we need to be very mindful of that. So brainstorming and thinking what would be best. I really look forward to the ideas that y'all's kind of assemblies and constituencies come forward.
Great. Next is Catherine.
Okay. So I actually have three questions, but one of them is kind of touching on what, I forget your name?
Richard.
What he was asking. So my first one was about how you're saying most cases involve students and don't really involve faculty or staff. Is this because most cases involving faculty are handled by some other entity, or is it just because there's a reporting issue and it's not being presented? My second question was touching on a little bit when you were talking about prevention, and so I was curious, given the statistics that you roughly have, the kinds of cases you're addressing, what programs you're doing with that. And then finally, you said that you don't really support interim measures, things like no contact and moving people to different dorms and stuff, and so I was just curious as to why. So there's a lot going on, so sorry about that, I just like jotted everything down.
It's not that I don't support interim measures, I just think that the bar is very high, so we're disrupting an individual's educational experience. And so the code sets a very high standard for those, and I echo that. So it's not that I would never use them, and again, I've used them when I thought was appropriate, so we did it in terms of suspension of a student organization, because we thought that it met the level of creating a risk to the university and let that organization continue. With the prevention, I think a lot of it is education, and I think it's demystifying the code and the regulations that are there, right? You know, we have these conversations of, these are the expectations of you as a Cornell community member, but it's not like anyone kind of said, you know, here's your code orientation book, right? It's a document that, you know, individuals come to the university, they don't think that they'll have to come through the process. And so I think the prevention that I'm really looking forward to is demystifying us. You know, I don't want it to be that people think that a referral to our office means that their entire career is done, right? It's a first-time alcohol violation, you don't repeat it, you complete the sanctions, you're back in good standing with our university. And so I think really having the opportunity to explain what it really means to be sent to the JA's office or to get JA'd and whatever, you know, part of speech that it gets used in the day. With the faculty and staff, I think when we look at the most number of cases that we have in our office, it's underage drinking. So a lot of the violations just wouldn't be applicable because faculty and staff tend to be over 21. I also think that when we look at brain development, and we know that brain development really reaches its full frontal cortex development at around 25 to 27. So faculty and staff, their decision-making prowess is a little bit more developed, and so we tend to see lesser cases for that. And then I think it is handled by different departments and in the workplace setting. I will tell you, interestingly, and Charlie and I have had this conversation, that the most faculty and staff cases that we get are people misusing IDs. So somebody's saying, hey, you're doing a lot of good work, you know, just go grab lunch on me. And those are the faculty and staff cases that we get. And so, you know, kind mistakes, but it still does impact security measures on our campus and it's a misuse of ID. So I think it's kind of those factors. I haven't been here long enough, I think, to say, you know, is this a trend for 1 year? But based on my records of past years, it seems to be such a minimal number of our caseload, and I think those are the main reasons.
If I recall correctly, I remember at one point, wait, what was the second most common code infraction?
It was public urination for
right.
A while, but luckily I think that people realize that the buildings are locked when they walk up from College Avenue, so we're glad for that.
Thank you for that. Okay, next, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No?
Okay, great. Next is Charlie.
I took a quick look at the codes for Penn, Stanford, and Columbia, and they're shorter by factors of 2, 4, and 5, respectively. Now, they may cover different things, you know, I didn't look that hard at it and so on, but is there a way of, is the cleaning up just the language without changing the rules, so to speak, is it possible to decouple that, or is it, you know, making something more readable, does that really quickly get into what we mean here type thing? I mean, how can, and also, if we redo the whole code, can we redo the whole code, and if so, can you break it up into chunks that are decoupled? How are we going to do this? That's my question.
Yeah, so any part of the code revision is at y'all's grace in the CJC. I just administer it, and so I don't sit on any committee. committee that has the right to write it or anything of that nature. And so one of the things that Matthew and Gabe and I have talked about is, you know, I've looked at other schools to see how they've done some of these proposals, and if they'd be willing to let me kind of draft just a kind of quick idea of how I think it might work and give it to this body and the CJC to really say, this might work, this might not work. I think there are ways to clean up the language, but that's from my perspective. I think there's a way to do that. And so I think there, but I think as soon as we say, okay, we're going to change this into this format, I think people have institutional distrust of my office, and I don't know how to build that trust. I think it's going to take time, and I think it's just the fear and the mystifying of it, and you know, really continuing to expound my commitment to transparency. So I think there is a way, but it's going to be up to y'all in the body and the community to see if that is possible.
So since Matt was referenced by name, I think, did you have something you wanted to add?
I did, because Charlie's point there. This is a discussion that I've had with Michelle, and a lot of what she said I completely echo. In terms of, can you revise the code to change the language without affecting the meaning, the person in my normal person happens to say absolutely, my lawyer in training hat, you're going to have, and it opens up a can of worms. A solution that I've heard floated is, you have the code and you have a plain language equivalent, but in the event of a typo, clearly we have that, frankly, legalese for better word, but even in the profession, there's a push towards plain language, that just, the language is clear. You can have both. It's a little more difficult, but I think that's possible. I think for us, considering the amount of time and effort we put into our code, it's certainly a possibility. And you know, also in terms of length, Cornell's code is unique in that it tries, in for many areas, it does encompass the entire campus community, whereas a lot of our peer institutions, it's just a student code of conduct, which necessarily removes a lot of things. Also, a lot of peer institutions, some of them have different quantums of proof, so instead of ours is clear, convincing, some level of preponderance. And I've also seen some interesting custom solutions. So it fits the institution. But that being said, I think there's a lot to learn from our peers. And I think as we go through trying to clean up, I think there's plenty to take and also plenty to say, we're different and that's okay.
Okay, great. And next is Joe.
So I have two questions. The one with the partnership with the Scheinman Institute and ADR, are you know students allowed to still appeal those, or do you find that is not really the case with those ADR cases, mainly because they seem to be more like rehabilitative? And then my second question is, you said you wanted to continue building campus partnerships for this year, and do you find that's going to be like integral in your ability to create more trust within the Cornell community specifically, mainly because I know that a lot more of the marginalized undergraduate students who come from historically marginalized backgrounds, that is like the main issue with the JA. It's the lack of trust, it's the lack of everything. So do you find that there are potential campus partnerships from non-academic parts like the Scheinman Institute into more personalized parts that could be beneficial for that building of trust?
Yeah, I think I'll answer your first question. Partnership with the Scheinman Institute doesn't revoke any rights in the code, so they still have the right to appeal if they're unhappy with the decision. Because most of the individuals, if they're willing to sign an SDA in our office, we haven't had to go to mediation because they're willing to kind of take it on the spot. So we're really looking at ways to maybe increase those numbers through some randomization to kind of do that. But the facilitated dialogue we've used as a sanction. So that means that the student has already agreed or the respondent has already agreed to participate in that. And to make sure that we're not kind of skewing the data, the Scheinman Institute collects the data. And it's been really positive. I think from a restorative point that the individual who felt that they've had not had the opportunity to explain, you know, why I was doing this decision making, and the person who's saying, you know, you might not have thought about this decision. And so that's been really the most positive aspect of that, is that we're doing some one-to-one building. More trust. Yeah, I accept any opportunity to speak to any group, whether it's a group of students. I met with two of them in Willard Strait, and we just sat and chatted towards kind of bigger presentations. And so I think some of it is that we always offer to, you know, we'd love to do presentations, we'd love to meet with you, we'd love to grab coffee with you, come to our office, we have candy and coffee, right? So it's just a matter of not getting kind of those invitations and kind of those thoughts. But my office is committed to meeting with any person who wants to meet with us in any group, because I think that just explaining and demystifying the code really helps. So if you want to talk offline, I'm very happy to look for opportunities that we may not have reached yet.
Marty?
Yes. You know, I was on the committee, chair of it, when the campus code was revised a number of years back. It was a long process. We took advantage of a lot of counsel around the university, both ones with degrees and people with degrees in the community. We had several community hearings, which had large participation from people from different components of the university. And we dealt with the question of, you know, how does this stack up to the other campus codes? In fact, I remember having a long discussion with Ari, right, who was in the campus assembly's office and was sort of shepherding this through, about whether or not we should fashion it after another code. And our conclusion was, what came out of our consultations with the community should be our guide. And we spent a lot of time revising as a consequence to the consultations with the community. This is a community code. If you read the opening paragraphs, they're meant not to be, okay, you're at Cornell, now here are the rules. But, okay, you're at Cornell and you're a member of a community. And the community, you have to get to know the community. And these are the ways that we aspire to have a community interact with each other. Community means faculty, employees, staff members, graduate students, undergraduate students, professional students. We're all in that community. It's a community code, and the outset, the opening statement says that clearly. I mean, I don't know whether there's other community codes. There's policies, and there are handbooks. And maybe in the handbook it says things like, you know, you're a part of a community and you better act this way because this community has these following goals. But this is a way of talking to the community about you're in this together and here are certain things you need to do. There's RAMPO, there's REME, you know, regulations of public order, REME. Those are the, what you could say, guidelines for structuring the community code to be able to fulfill those requirements. But you know, when I hear people say, "Oh, the code's too long," or "Oh, the code's got you know, too complicated," and everything like that, well, for heaven's sakes, find out where it's too long. And if you read it closely, find out where it is that you think it's saying too much about something. But do it in the context of thinking that this is a way of setting a inspirational, moral, you know, judicial kind of message to about what it constitutes to live together in an educational environment, which means, yes, professors telling students what the realities are, but it also means you know, figuring out ways that transfer of information can be based in a spirit of, you know, energizing and future going, and not dependency. And not overbearing power relationships. That's what constitutes the future community. And I think it's built into the code. It's built into its initial statement. It's built into the subsequent paragraphs that talk about how you should protest and what are the guidelines for protest. There's a lot of stuff like that that's in the code. And if those are the things that are thought to be wordy, then I'd like to see somebody craft something that's better, that captures that same spirit and that same purpose. And I think that it's very important to think about this in relation to this question of policies, which, you know, are generally, my experience in this governance system, very often they're used to say, this is what the rules are, and these have been decided by and passed by. I think the code says, well, there may be policies, but this is the way that they get incorporated in and energized in the community in ways that make you feel like you're in this together, as opposed to you're being subjugated. And I think if you look at a lot of the codes in different institutions, because they are student-centered, that differential is very clear. That is not in our code. Look at the protest one. Now, if you're going to say protest, I'm sorry to take so long, but if you're going to look at the protest section, it makes it clear that what has happened at Cornell since the 1960s, maybe even before, which is that faculty, students, staff, we're all engaged very often in these protesting activities together. And it shouldn't be that students are, you know, whipped in with a different kind of whip, you know, or that have to face different consequences. It should be that we're doing it all in the same, with the same spirit, with the same understanding of the risks and the same need to conform to certain guidelines. Okay, that's just one example, but it goes throughout the code. And I'd suggest that we, when we take on this role of revisions or whatever, we have the benefit of your counsel, all of you who feel that it's too wordy or it's too long or something like that. But your counsel should be specifically, what words are too many, and what are they saying that doesn't belong in the code, as you can see the code has been constructed, the purposes of it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I make a quick point for that report? Are we looking at what you stop the laptop?
I can't see it, so would the clerk go collect that item? I don't think the recorder is on. Or I don't think we're using the recorders we used to be using. I imagine it's been digitized. But thank you for bringing that up. If you and Gina could figure that out, that would be great. Seeing as we're running low on time and there are still some people left on the speakers list, Michelle, did you have anything that you wanted to say in response to that, or would you like to take the next few questions?
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think the ideals of the code are magnificent. I wouldn't ever want to work at an institution where I didn't believe in that. And I think when you look at different codes of different institutions, right, a Brigham Young code of conduct looks very different than a Cornell versus a UVA versus a state college, because those are the values that they want to protect, and those are the qualities that they want to say that their graduates possess. And so, you know, I think when we look at some of our peer colleagues and we look at other institutions who we benchmark each other, I think, you know, they expound some of the same lofty ideas. And so I think the issue is there are parts of the code, and I think this is because it has been piecemealed and kind of looked at, that it does kind of contradict itself. And we always give the benefit of the doubt to the respondent. And there have been some federal laws that have been passed, particularly FERPA, since the advent of the code. And so there are some federal laws that we just can't enforce certain provisions of the code because we'd be violating federal law and we'd be risking our financial aid. And so those are some of the things that I think are major priorities. But I echo your thoughts that this should be a community document where we say these are the values that this community is saying that we're trying to preserve. Again, I just administer the code, right? I don't have any dog in the fight. I particularly don't make public comments because I don't want to be seen as someone who's swaying any thoughts. But I think the questions are, you know, are we looking at one code of conduct with different procedures? Are we looking at one code in which we're saying, you know, the inequity of referrals are some ways, you know, because of the decision making that we've addressed with Katie, but is it also because there is a hesitancy to refer things at an equitable level because the sanctions would be disproportionate for faculty and staff in a way that would be less proportionate for students for the same offenses? And so I think, you know, it's always awkward when I have to read a faculty member's paper, and they're well written, which is wonderful, and things of like that. But it's kind of an odd aspect that we really looked at. And for example, what are the consistent reporting requirements? So I think as we're looking at what a code revision would look like, I think it's also looking at where do we have gaps that we need to make sure that we have equality if we're keeping all constituency groups under it.
Thank you.
Great, thanks. So we have two more people on the speakers list. Next up is Elena.
Hi, thank you for your presentation. I just have a really quick question. I'm very curious about the research that your student intern did over the summer. Are you going to publish that anywhere? Or?
So she didn't do research to publish, but she created documents. So for example, we now have a guide that we provide to individuals who have been accused of hazing, because we also realize that they're victims of hazing as well, traditionally. So a lot of it is more practical documents that we're going to be using in our office. She also did some work with presentations to really have a student perspective of the history of hazing, right, and how we even got the name of hazing. So I don't know if there's going to be a published report, but I'm happy to talk with you about some of the things that she has done.
Okay.
is Anna.
Okay, since no one else has done this, I'm going to be the uncomfortable one. As you can imagine, this body was intensely interested last year in Mitch McBride's case, as he was a member of ours, and even regardless, I think we would have been. Several of us even attempted to attend the hearing. I know Marty had to leave because of the audio difficulties. And given the interest in the process, the interest in the application of the code, can I ask you to speak to your perspective on how this case was initiated, how you think the logistics of the whole process went, what went well, and where there might be room for improvement? I'm sorry to be so very blunt.
No, thank you for asking a curious question. So how cases are initiated? So we talked about the online reporting form. So if we get a report from our office, our duty is to evaluate it and investigate it. So we had to move forward with any complaint that comes to our office. We say if there's, through our initial investigation, that there may not be enough to substantiate it, or we don't have jurisdiction. So for example, if someone said, you know, Jim Carrey was mooning the building. Well, Jim Carrey's not a student, don't have jurisdiction, case would be closed. But because of the way that our system is in place, is that individuals who file individual complaints have the right to do what's called a show cause, to say, Madam J, you made the wrong decision. Jim Carrey is a student, so you should take jurisdiction of their case, and then there's a check on that. We move forward with cases where we think that there is credible ability to find clear and convincing that a violation did occur. The way that we move forward is that we meet with an individual, we schedule a meeting, we say, okay, tell us, right now we only have one side of the story, so talk to us about where things are from your perspective. After that, we propose what's called a summary decision agreement, and where we say, you know, if you think that there's responsibility, or you think by clear and convincing evidence, a hearing board found you responsible for this, here are the sanctions that you agree to. Individuals get 2 days to consider that, and after 2 days, we charge it to a hearing board. Because we think that, you know, there's no sense in lagging this procedure. If we can't come to an agreement, let's go to the third party, which is the hearing board. Our office makes it a practice not to allow individuals to revoke their complaints. And we do that because we're very cognizant of the fear of retaliation. And individuals saying, well, the process is going through. And we see it particularly with group misconduct cases, is that things get revoked. And so we say our responsibility is to enforce and protect the educational environment of the university. So individuals can't revoke their process moving forward. So we think there's too much compromise in the system. And so from there, it plays out. It goes to a hearing board. The hearing board makes a decision. If there's an appeal, there's an appeal, and it goes forth. In that instance, and the public record will provide that, but I recognize that there is interest in that because of his stature at the university, and I'm going to leave it to the hearing decisions to let you kind of explore that. The logistics of it. So that was the first public hearing that the university's had in 7 or 9 years. So these are things that are very rare. They don't happen often. And so I think the idea was, how do we, one, maintain control? Because there was public safety concerns. And so we need to say, we worked with various campus colleagues to make sure that there was police on site, to make sure that things were not putting anyone in future harm. So if people want to protest, they could do it in a way that was not causing, you know, fire safety violations and things of that nature. I think looking forward, if we ever have a public hearing again, I've already asked Gabe that if there's a public hearing request, that the University Assembly pay for Bailey Hall. I don't want to be put in a position where we think that you know, we're not being transparent. We did the best we could. You know, we tried to do audio and video. We had audio video testing the day of, because we did, on the request of the chair, move the room to a larger space. And there was some kind of procedural stuff in the back where motions were not made to move to bigger spaces. So I think looking forward, again, we'll be asking for some partnership if there is a public hearing request to not have to question that. So we did debrief with the chair of the proceeding, as well as the University Hearing and Review Board Administrative Chair, to make sure that we have the proper standards and procedures in place if it were ever to happen again. So does that kind of answer the places that you were looking to get some questions?
Thank you.
Great, thanks. Well, that that exhausts our speakers list. Thank you very much for agreeing to come and present to us in September. I know we look forward to seeing you next month for the more formal report in October. So thanks again. Can we give her? All right, great. Well, feel free to stay. Anna, did you have something you wanted to add?
Motion to close business.
There's been a motion to close business. There's been a second. All right, we will now move into discussion on the motion to adjourn. Wait, do you mean close this presentation?
Don't we have to close business to go to committee reports now? Or
no, because we already went over the speaker's time, so I just moved it through. Okay, I thought you meant the motion to adjourn.
No,
okay.
I want
great.
Not to speak.
That's okay. So yeah, we're just going to move right on to committee reports. There's only one left. Matt, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. I will be cognizant of the time. I apologize for my tardiness. I had to do a class. I had to sneak out to get here. In terms of the CJC, we'll be meeting tomorrow afternoon for our first meeting. I was actually trying to take care of it before this. There will be an email going out this evening with an agenda and scheduling. First meeting is primarily going to be quote-unquote nuts and bolts in terms of scheduling meetings and trying to catch everyone back up to speed from last semester. Looking at the volume ahead of the CJC, we're seriously contemplating going to weekly meetings where possible, just because the CJC has a very large volume of work to do, as you saw with Ms. Horvath's presentation. We also are looking forward to welcoming the hearing board chair to one of our meetings, hopefully in the next few weeks or so, to discuss some of the items that were brought up by the Mr. McBride hearing, as well as the procedures in general. We look forward to that. And I look forward to keeping the body appraised as we move forward, and I welcome any input. Our meetings are public, so if anyone wants to be added to the CBC Info Listserv, please feel free to ask myself or the Office of Assemblies, and we'll make sure you get all of our emails. So thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, Matt. Any other questions for Matt? All right. Seeing no questions, and I guess we technically have 1 or 2 minutes left, but I guess, so yeah, the only other thing is we skipped late additions to the agenda. There were none, so that's okay.
I have one question.
Oh, okay. Let's.
Is it possible we could meet in the other room? Because this is hard to hear in here.
Yeah, so the next meeting is scheduled to be in this room again, but I am happy to talk with the Office of the Assemblies and see if we could arrange for a room with better acoustics. But I agree. I much prefer that room, too. I think that there is something else.
Is there a class there? Is that the problem is?
In 401 PSP?
Yes.
It's being used by the department, so it's just, we'd certainly try that first. When that's not available, we use this building, so.
All of our students there is the ones they could be because of others.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's why I was asking. So all of our meetings are scheduled there from now on. That's all I was asking.
Except for the next one.
The next one will also be in here, but then they are there, yes.
Sorry, just curious because I.
No, that's okay. Any other late additions that people want to bring up? Didn't think so.
Motion to adjourn.
It's been a motion to adjourn. Is there a second? Any dissent? All right, seeing no dissent, the meeting is adjourned, and I will see you guys in 2 weeks. Thank you.
I feel as though I'm not, but I also feel as though that I will have to take it.
So I think and I think that we get this point. And I think it's planning to set up a which means that we'll be asking to nominate people.
Yeah. Well, the only issue is that I will not be, the SA will not nominate me because I am not a formalized member. Because I was under the impression that consensual relationships would come from CWC itself.
No.
Let me toss that down.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's what happens. But is there any?
I don't think there's. I think I'm allowed to serve. Like, I'm.
The effort is not the effort. The effort has to do with
Yeah. So
it has to be an under.
It has to be under. Yeah. I think I will end up taking that because I know how the calendar committee worked. It was an SA member and then a non-SA member. So I would call it.
Well, we don't even know how many.
Exactly.
So,
I just know calendar was two, so I would assume this one would be two.
Three then. Yeah. But, I mean, we don't want that situation. We want the six equal.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I could also see that of an equitable membership because it's also that you see grad students kind of have this more often than undergrads most of the time. There are undergraduate like stories, tales.
Well, but the thing is, like,
you still want.
It could also be.
Yeah, that's
so.
Yeah. Which.
That
one happens quite often.
Right?
Yes.
Not as dead. All right.